You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, please stay tuned for the latest in space news and retrospective documentary features. This is The Space Show. Now, pay close attention to the lyrics of our opening music as it sets out the theme of this evening's program. Was Cosmonauts on the Moon from David Cox's 2015 rocket opera of the same name. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie, and on Mission Control we have Jay. Now, on this evening's The Space Show, something old and something new. We look back 60 years to the pioneer moonshots, then back 50 years to the Soviet Union's abortive attempt to build a giant moon rocket, that's the fanfare from the Cosmonauts on the Moon rocket opera. Well, this week is the 60th anniversary of the final in an often overlooked series of unmanned moonshots. This evening, we tell the fascinating story of the pioneer missions. Wind the clock back, way, way back to 1958, August the 17th. Yeah, I know that's a bit more than 60 years. And we're talking about Lunar Probe Able 1. Now, it was intended to place Lunar Probe in the vicinity of the Moon and measure the space environment. The Thor Able 3-stage rocket lifted off from Cape Canaveral, but an engine failure in the first stage caused the vehicle to explode 77 seconds after launch. The project was directed by the United States Air Force, who promptly handed the Lunar Probe project over to the newly formed NASA. In later years, Lunar Probe Able 1 was retrospectively named Pioneer Zero. Just 11 days after its formation, NASA tried to launch a deep space probe for the study of radiation in the Earth-Moon space and to measure the magnetic fields of Earth and Moon. Called Pioneer 1, it carried image-scanning infrared television to study the lunar surface. Liftoff of the Thor Able rocket appeared normal as it rose from Cape Canaveral. A slight error in burnout velocity and angle limited the flight. This report was prepared in 1958 for the United States Air Force.
19 August 1958. Thor Missile 129 was erected on Pad 17A at the Air Force Missile Test Center, Cape Canaveral, Florida, in preparation for the second launch in the Able 1 space probe program. At the same time, operations to recover parts of the first vehicle, Missile No. 127, were underway several miles offshore from the Cape. Subsequent study of the recovered parts indicated the explosion in Missile 127 resulted from a random type failure of the turbopump number 5 bearing. Because a fix for this type of malfunction had been developed, it was decided to reschedule Missile 129 to the last of the three launches in order to permit the incorporation of appropriate modifications. The scheduled September launch was then moved back 1 month, and Thor Missile 130 was substituted as the first stage of the second Able 1 vehicle. It was erected on the launch pad on the 22nd of September. All stages of the second lunar probe vehicle were identical to those used in the first launch. The second stage was mated on 2 October, the third stage on the 8th of October. A flight readiness firing with the Thor first stage had been previously conducted on 1 October. The fourth stage payload package, officially named Pioneer, was identical to that of the first launch, except for the addition of an ion chamber for radiation tests. The ion chamber was fabricated and constructed by the Space Technology Laboratories following a design of Dr. Van Allen of the State University of Iowa. It is capable of measuring the broad range of radiation intensity from 10 to 1 million rentgens per hour. This new experiment replaced the low sensitivity unit of the magnetometer experiment in the telemetry frequencies. During the period between the first and second launches, modifications were also made in the Florida and Hawaiian microlock equipment to permit cine-wave ranging operations instead of trapezoidal ranging as previously planned. In Florida, the associated antennas were also raised from the ground and installed on the trailer roof to permit a better look angle during the immediate pre-launch period. The countdown for the second launch began on 10 October. 2 of the 5 hours of built-in holds were utilized in tracing a random short in the payload package, and 1 hour was consumed in resolving a first-stage structural problem. In the early hours of the morning of 11 October, final preparations and fueling were completed. The gantry was moved back, and the missile stood poised in the flood of searchlights. During the critical period of the terminal count, a 10-second hold was called because of a failure to activate an arming switch. At 3:42 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on October 11th, the second Able 1 vehicle was launched from Pad 17A. Although operation of the missile appeared normal, later analysis of tracking information and telemetry data indicated excessive thrust. It was about 4% higher than expected, and autopilot drift in the first stage burning period. These two factors resulted in a 2.5 to 3 degree lofting of the vehicle by the first stage. The second stage also was lofted about 2 degrees. The total lofting effect contributed to a second stage shutdown velocity that was 200 feet per second below normal. This was not due to a fault in the integrating accelerometer, which cuts off the second stage burning. Instead, because of first stage lofting, the initial velocity and attitude of the second stage was higher than programmed, and the apparent velocity, as measured by the integrating accelerometer, was higher than the vehicle's true velocity, thus causing an early shutdown. Studies of telemetry data secured during the flight indicate that after second stage engine cutoff, and before ignition of the third stage, a disturbance of an unknown nature occurred and caused an error in the third stage azimuth by approximately 15 degrees to the north. This severe change of attitude might have resulted from instability of the thrust of the third stage rocket during the separation. Telemetry data indicates a spin rate of approximately 120 RPM instead of the expected 140 RPM. Preliminary analysis showed the third stage provided a velocity gain of approximately 11,640 feet per second. By the time of third stage burnout, the altitude and attitude of the vehicle were about 6 degrees higher than nominal, and the velocity was from 400 to 600 feet per second below the expected value. Although this velocity deviation is a small percentage of the 35,000 feet per second required, a velocity loss of only 1% reduces the maximum attainable distance by one-half. All 8 vernier rockets were fired to give maximum increase to velocity. However, within a couple of hours, it was evident the probe vehicle would not reach the vicinity of the moon. About 21.5 hours after liftoff, the fourth stage reached its apogee of approximately 62,000 nautical miles, more than one-third of the distance to the moon. During the flight of the vehicle, more than 100 hours of telemetry data were recorded on magnetic tape by the tracking stations in the United States, Manchester, England, Singapore, and Hawaii. The tracking data received were more than adequate, with the exception of high-altitude Doppler. Preliminary analysis of telemetry data connected with the various payload experiments reveal that the high-sensitivity micrometeorite channel recorded 8 hits during the first 10 hours, while only 1 hit was recorded by the low-sensitivity unit. Quick look ion chamber information indicated a maximum recorded radiation level of 9.7 rentgens per hour at a distance of approximately 8,000 miles. This level dropped to 2/10 rentgens per hour at about 15,000 miles. Knowledge of this nature is of vital importance whenever it is desired to put man into space flights or orbits. Calculations made after it was known the payload would not reach the vicinity of the moon indicated that it might be placed in an orbit about the Earth by firing the retro rocket. The first opportunity to fire the rocket came 28 hours after launch, when the payload, which was now on its path back to Earth, passed high over the Cape Canaveral launch area. These attempts to fire the rocket from Florida were unsuccessful. Attempts were then made from the STL station in Hawaii, but these also failed, and after a flight of 43 hours and 28 minutes, the vehicle plunged back into Earth's atmosphere somewhere over the South Pacific near the coast of South America. Inability to fire the retro rocket can be attributed to malfunction of electronic equipment due to degraded battery performance at low temperatures. Although it is possible to obtain batteries which operate at much lower temperatures, the mercury cells employed in the payload are the most efficient type of battery available in terms of maximum life and minimum weight. Various paint patterns, foil wrappings, and reflectors had been designed to control interior temperatures of the payload package at an average of 70 plus or minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. However, several unpredictable factors offset this and lowered the temperature to 36 degrees, the most important factor being the incorrect attitude of the payload package in relation to the sun, which resulted from the performance deviations in the other stages as described earlier. Nevertheless, the launch of the Able 1 vehicle earned a place in history as the first vehicle to pierce deep into outer space, traveling farther and faster than any other man-made object. Most important of all, it collected valuable scientific data that provided a new insight into the nature of our universe and changed man's thinking on space travel problems.
So to recap, Pioneer 1 reached an altitude of 113,000 kilometers before falling back to Earth. It re-entered the atmosphere over the South Pacific 43 hours after liftoff. All was not lost. It was able to measure the Van Allen radiation belt and determine its ionizing flux. Pioneer 1 also made the first observation of hydromagnetic oscillations of Earth's magnetic field. If that were not enough, Pioneer 1 also made the first micrometeor density measurements in outer space. Which brings us to 1958, November the 8th, and Pioneer 2. NASA launched its second Pioneer moon probe with different instruments from its predecessor. Unfortunately, the third stage of the Thor Able rocket failed to ignite. It re-entered the atmosphere 42 minutes after launch, having reached an altitude of 1,500 kilometres. As with Pioneer 1, the instrumentation worked and provided evidence that the equatorial region about the Earth has a higher radiation flux and energy than had previously been suspected. So forward again to 1958, December the 6th. Pioneer 3. Pioneer 3 failed to reach escape velocity, but did reach a peak altitude of 102,000 kilometres. After 38 hours, Pioneer 3 entered the atmosphere and burnt up. Before doing so, Pioneer 3 discovered a second radiation belt around the Earth. This report was prepared in late 1958 by the newly formed NASA.
An attempt was scheduled on December 6th to place a United States space probe beyond the moon. Jupiter was selected as boost vehicle for this Juno 2 rocket, which was to launch Pioneer 3. At the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, Huntsville, Alabama, the first stage was modified for this mission, and test run. On the West Coast, in Pasadena, California, at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the second, third, and fourth stages were assembled. The payload cone undergoing vibration testing was 23 inches long and 10 inches at maximum diameter. Several days before scheduled launch time, the first stage was brought to the launching pad. The morning before launch, the payload was hoisted, positioned in the vehicle, and given final checkout. A few hours before launch, the fueling operation began. On December 6th, Juno 2 stood ready on the launching pad. It weighed 121,000 pounds at liftoff. Burnout of the first stage, the booster motor separated from the guidance compartment and nose section. Almost simultaneously, the nose section was detached by an explosive charge and moved out of the way by a small rocket motor. Meanwhile, jets of the guidance system were activated to place the high-speed stages and the payload in proper firing attitude of direction. A brief period of coasting followed. Now, with the rocket in effect aimed at its target, the spin-stabilized high-speed stages commenced their firing sequence. With the firing of the last stage rocket, the probe has now achieved escape velocity. After a long period of coasting, about 10 hours, the burned-out fourth stage is separated from the probe payload, and a de-spinning device consisting of weights attached to wires is activated to stop the spinning motion of the probe. The probe payload will now coast on into space. Pioneer 3 rose to an altitude of 63,580 statute miles.
We now bring our story to 1959, January the 2nd, and Luna 1. The Soviet Union launched Luna 1 with the intention of impacting the moon. It missed the moon and went into heliocentric orbit. That's an orbit around the sun, just like the Earth is an orbit around the sun. It was the first artificial planet and was promptly renamed Mechta. Which brings us to this week's anniversary. On 1959, March the 3rd, NASA again tried for the moon. Pioneer 4 was supposed to pass close by the moon and measure its radiation. Because the Juno 2 four-stage rocket injected Pioneer 4 on an Earth-Moon trajectory 300 kilometers per hour below the planned velocity, it passed 60,000 kilometers from the Moon on March the 4th and went into orbit around the Sun, the second artificial planet. This newsreel report of the launch comes from a commercial company.
The 60-ton, four-stage Juno launching rocket, on its site at Cape Canaveral, ready for the new attempt to probe outer space. A gold-plated fiberglass cone shielding the 13-pound instrument capsule is hoisted aloft for attachment. This is the brain of Pioneer 4. Wernher von Braun, one of the big brains behind these American space probes, is present for the launching. Midnight is to be the witching hour, and it's a tense and dramatic scene as the rocket is fueled for its fantastic flight. liquid oxygen boiling off from the fuel tanks. The objective of the rocket's payload is to bypass the moon, to send back important data on radiation and other scientific information, and to continue its journey into orbit round the sun. Stand by for the big blast. Up she goes, and this time it's a huge success. Pioneer 4 is on the way to send a tiny speck of gold circling the sun, perhaps forever. Britain's Jodrell Bank radio telescope, the largest of its kind in the world, started tracking it within minutes of its launching. And it's the first to track a man-made object beyond the distance of the moon.
Pioneer 4 was tracked for 82 hours to a distance of 650,000 kilometres. It yielded important radiation data in space, but was unable to do the planned near-lunar experiments. The first object to hit the moon was Luna 2, but that happened in 1959, September the 13th.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
And now we jump forward a decade from 1959 to 1969. The objective was now human missions to the moon. In the Soviet Union, rocket scientist Sergei Korolev had designed a huge rocket to achieve that. It was called the N1. This music celebrates that effort. That was called Rocket 2, and it comes from David Cox's 2015 rocket opera. And as I said, the song was about Korolev's N1 rocket. Well, our anniversary 50 years ago, 1969, February the 21st, okay, during the last week, The attempt to send a simplified L1 spacecraft to the moon for a flyby was made. It launched on the N1 from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. There was a premature shutdown of some of the engines of the first stage. Now, tracking through the rest of the N1 rocket program, 1969, July the 3rd. That's just days before the famous Apollo 11 mission. Again, it was launched, and what happened was that metal entering an oxidizer pump caused an explosion of one of the 31st stage engines. And that resulting explosion destroyed the launch complex and made a hell of a mess. So it was a little while, nearly 2 years, before they tried again on 1971, June the 27th. And the rocket rolled soon after liftoff, and excessive torques started a destruction of the second stage. And then at 51 seconds, the first stage engines shut down and the whole assembly came crashing back down to the ground. Jump forward a year and a half nearly, 1972, November the 23rd. This is the fourth launch of the N1, and all went well for 90 seconds. But then some of the engines shut down, a fuel lines broke, and the vehicle exploded at 107 seconds into the mission. Well, the final story, part of the story, is in 1974, August. President Brezhnev cancelled the program, and so the N1 was never launched to the moon, it never launched cosmonauts, and the Soviets never landed on the moon. That didn't stop David Cox from writing his rocket opera called Cosmonauts on the Moon, and this particular track from that opera is Century 20.
All that is fallen, melted to air. The 20th century, well, you have to be there. If it happened before, it will happen again. Learn from your mistakes or repeat them again. It seems that we don't get what was obvious then. The same things keep happening again and again. It's all there in the history of the 20th century.
And let's have another one from David Cox. This one's called Look at All the Stars. From the rock opera, or rocket opera, rocket opera, Cosmonauts on the Moon. Now let's hear another track from that opera. It's called Moon So Bright.
Moon
Look at the moon so bright. It shines for them all tonight. Cosmic in a sea of stars, at one with the universe. A final brave unity sets them in eternity. We remember them all at night. So look at the lunar light. Eternity. So look at the moon so bright.
Well, so that was 50 years ago. The N1 rocket didn't fail. Look, we've got three versions of that song about the N1. Jay is pulling his hair out. But look, Jay doesn't mind me saying, look, he was born in Russia. He comes from Russia, so he should be proud of the N1, even though it failed. So let's have another version of Rocket 2. On this evening's Space Show, we've been looking at the 70th anniversary of the first attempts to send probes to the moon and the N1 rocket 50 years ago was attempted to be launched and, as we said, was a dismal failure. And on the Space Show, we're about out of time. Going to hand over to Nick Black and let's go out with another version, yes, the third version of the N1 rocket.
Why do you have to do that to me, Andrew? Why?
Here comes a rocket, the N1 rocket, too many engines, unstable. disable engines. Here comes the rocket, the N1 rocket.